You know, it wasn't until the 19th century when books became readily available, especially for the low income. I grew up with books. I loved to read. In fact, I would find corners where mom and dad couldn't find me because I wanted to read. And they always had one more chore for me to do. But for thousands of years, we told our stories around campfires, in the halls of kings and queens, and in the mud huts in the heart of Africa. There's something about a story that's told, and there's something sacred about a story that's heard. In these conversations, I'm just trying to provide a time and space to hear the stories of people around me. I knew each person before we sat down to speak and to listen, but I always came away from each conversation with a deeper appreciation and a deeper admiration for a person I already appreciated and admired. I hope you enjoy these conversations, and I hope you feel inspired to provide a space and time to hear the stories of others. Welcome to these unfiltered conversations. Well, good morning. This morning I'm with Karu, and I always have a hard time pronouncing your last name. It's spelled
N-J-O-G-U.
N-J-O-G-U.
The N is silent, so it's kind of like Njogu.
Jogu.
I get it.
It's like yogurt.
Right.
Okay, I think I'll remember that now. Well, I got to know Karu a number of years ago. I'm not exactly sure how long it's been, but I bank at First Source, and there was a turnover in management there, and Karu showed up. And one day I was introduced to Karu Jogu, and always from the very beginning, I appreciated your demeanor and who you were and the way you operated, and so I've always appreciated that about you. So I'm here this morning with you, and I'm just going to start this conversation. We'll see where it goes.
See where it goes.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about yourself, about your childhood, where you came from, some important things in your life, kind of whatever you want to tell me this morning.
Sure. So I'm originally from Kenya. So Africa, East Africa specifically. And grew up in what we would call then the central province of Kenya, which is more of the kind of your highlands, rainy, good vegetation, as opposed to being arid or semi-arid. I was born third in a family of 10 children.
Okay.
So with mom and dad, you know, we used to like to say it's a football team plus one. Football here being soccer.
I was going to say, no, it's a different football than what we would think of them.
Yeah. And so born third came with responsibilities.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when, and I'll fast forward, I will jump here. When I graduated high school, our last born sister was a year old. Yeah. So, you know, we ended up just pretty much bringing her up. This is how the spread of the children was. It was, by all means, a fun childhood, not without specific challenges of the kind of environment that we grew up in. But it's much better now. Looking back, a lot of kiddie things, you know, little fights here and there, of course. Scarce resources and, but scarcity was in levels. To some, we looked to be very able. And when we looked at ourselves, we were not that able, you know, speaking financially or our economic situation. But very early on, I remember knowing that we were blessed to a degree, that we didn't have it as bad, even though I was reminded occasionally that we needed more blessings, so to say. Grew up around a mother who was, and still is, very generous, very hospitable, as a woman of faith, which she came to faith when we were really, really young. The way she would put it, I think, is I've always known God, but I think in 87, she had what was called a born-again experience. It revolutionized her life and really shaped the outcome of our family. I think that to the largest extent, my mother's faith was responsible for keeping the family intact. Intact meaning the family didn't break up, there was no divorce. I think that her faith played a significant role in that. But yeah, I can go all, you know, different ways, but I think maybe we could start there.
Okay. You know. So when you said did kiddie things, you know, what were some of your favorite childhood memories, things that you did or played or,
I like to think we were the kings of improvisation. You know, we loved improvising whatever it is that we felt like we wanted to play with. I remember one of my earliest memories was sitting on some kind of cloth. I'm not sure if I was walking then or crawling. I'm not sure. But I remember vividly, I was actually remembering this not so long ago, a few days ago. I remember my eldest brother and my brother, my dad had bought some kind of a toy gun for my eldest brother. And when he would push on the trigger, it would let out like sparks, you know. Uh-huh. This is, gosh, early 80s, you know. And I remember him chasing my elder brother around our little house, you know. And my elder brother's just screaming. I mean, he was terrified. And we're going round and round the house. And for some reason, I remember being so scared for my elder brother, but there was nothing I could do. And I'm just sitting there and I'm watching this whole thing. And so, you know, things like that. I remember the part where we grew up before my dad built his own house. And we were living in my uncle's house. Then this is when I was under 5 years old. And this one time we had two guard dogs that were not like your pet dogs as you would, you know, in Western culture. It doesn't mean they were loved less, but they were not house dogs. They were to be outside. They had their own kennel and but they used to be hunting dogs as well. And I remember this one time seeing a gazelle across the valley where we used to live. It was kind of like atop a valley that had a creek running through it. And I remember seeing our two dogs literally hunt a gazelle and pin it down. And then our neighbors, because they were bigger boys than we were, they went and caught the gazelle, slaughtered it. And I remember eating my first game meat. Tasted like, it's funny because to me it tasted like clay.
Clay?
Yeah.
Didn't taste like chicken like everything.
It tasted like clay because part of the thing that we used to do when we were little is go down the valley. And people used to make bricks out of clay.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they would get the clay, they would leave like some sort of, you know, just a hole because they used up the clay. And so the space would be filled up by water. And we used to go into those little man-made ponds and we would try to swim around there.
Okay.
And so when you're coming out of the little pond, you know, your hands are full of clay and some way, somehow, the clay will find its way to your mouth because you're little, you know. So things like that are my earliest and fondest of memories. I was swimming in little man-made ponds, going around the coffee farm and, you know, seeing bugs climbing trees, making soccer balls out of paper and yarn, out of like discarded paper, like what you would use at Walmart, you know, paper bags. So we would get a bunch of those, we would squeeze them together and use yarn and really make a nice soccer ball, because it was unaffordable to get a soccer ball. So so we used to make that, and we would play soccer all day. You know, we also used to make, I remember, little like race cars. They would make out of some kind of cabling, some kind of wires, some kind of copper wires or things like that. And they would make little cars, and we would tie a string to the cars, and we would have a race. And we used to think if you had the best car, you won the race. Don't ask me why, but we never thought that the fastest of us would always win.
So the fastest runner with the worst car still wins.
Exactly.
So, at 5 years old, that doesn't sink in.
It doesn't. Then I remember playing hide and seek. That was my favorite. Although it got us into big trouble with our mother, because where we grew up, there wasn't large-scale farming as you would here in the United States. You know, you own an acre, not an acreage, maybe a quarter of an acre if you're lucky, you know. And on that quarter acre is your family home, and it's the place that you farm to get food to eat, you know, or at least subsidize what you need from that little space, and then the rest of what you need you buy from the store. So my mother would plant potatoes, and I remember this one time we played hide and seek so much with our village kids, you know, and it was the fastest hide and seek you've ever seen. You know, it was like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know. And then by that time, you needed to have hit. So we would jump, we would fly across my mother's little potato garden. And of course, we ruined her.
I was gonna say, I think I'm awake so then.
So we used to get into a lot of trouble, but it was a lot of fun. I think we also loved music. The song, I think, reaches across all cultures. And some of the songs we would hear from the radio were, of course, you know, American songs, and we didn't know English. I mean, by that time, maybe you haven't even started school, or even if you've gone to school, you know, English is a subject, you know. And I remember us singing those songs in our own language, using our own words, you know. And sometimes When I was 29, turning 30 is when I came to this country. And there was a time I listened to one of the songs we used to sing, and I couldn't believe it, because in my brain, I was singing it with my made-up African words. You know? And it was completely different. So we used to make little instruments. We would go to the kitchen, get pans, pots, something, and then, you know, cut sticks from, you know, the fence and play on them and just make music. And so then we would go when it would rain, because like I said, coming from the central province, it means that there was good rain and enough food if you grew it. You know, so the rains, we would go outside when it was raining. There was this superstition that if you get rained on, you grow taller.
Oh, yeah.
So we liked being outside because we wanted to grow taller. You know?
And that's how it works, huh?
Yeah, and so we would find a little hill, or we would make one. We would gather mud and we would make kind of like a little rise, and we would slide. So if I pull up my pants and you see my knees, I have a lot of scars, you know, to prove my fun, a lot of fun that I had. So we would slide down, then you would get cut by some piece of random glass, random rock, you know. So things like that. We would also make, my goodness, this sort of like carts that we used to make with wood. And then we would go to on asphalt roads where there was a slope, because it didn't have an engine or any kind of it was not a motorized type of thing. So you needed some kind of slope to give it speed, and we would drive those things and crash badly. But it was a lot of fun.
So you grew up not speaking English. What was your first language?
So my African native language is called Kikuyu. It's spoken by maybe about, I don't want to use a number here because I would be probably wrong. But if I were to throw out a number, maybe 3 to 4 million people.
Okay.
And so that's what I was speaking. That was my mom and dad's, you know, if you would call this tribal language. I think tribe is insufficient, but we'll use it for now. And so all the way until I went to school, and when I went to school, I studied Swahili as a subject. And English was, of course, the curriculum. So from what we called nursery school then, which I think is your version of kindergarten.
Okay.
The whole curriculum was in English. So we would take math in English, not in Swahili or my African native. But then I took 3 years of my African native, which was really unique. These only used to happen in the rural areas, where they would teach the local African language spoken by the people there. In the cities, it was not the case. So I felt I was very lucky. I can still read it. I can still write it. It's a very simple language. So we got done with it by third grade.
Okay.
But because it was my primary language, I've of course never forgotten it. So,
yeah.
Then I picked up Swahili in school and picked up English in school.
So you speak the three languages?
Yeah, I read, write. Yeah. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
I suppose sometimes it gets confusing.
It does, honestly. I remember this one time at the bank, the other bank I used to work for. I had called my mother on the phone, or my brother, I forget. But we had spoken for a few minutes when I was on break, and then I hang up the phone, and one of my colleagues came back in the break room and said something to me, and I answered them. And they looked at me bewildered, and I'm thinking, why are you looking at me like that? And then he asked me a question, and then I answered him again. And his eyes got even bigger. He says, "Karu, I can't understand what you're saying." I said, "What do you mean?" So, and just only to realize I answered him twice in Swahili. So,
this was Swahili that came out.
Yeah, it's Swahili that came out. Yeah. I find that when there's like an emotional high state, good or bad, it's almost anything will come out. So I find this mostly, especially when my guard is down at home, I will not know. I could speak one sentence and it will have three languages in it.
And your kids look at you and
what is
wrong
with you? Exactly.
So now we're pretty far from Africa, and so most of us, I've had the opportunity of being in Kenya, mostly in Nairobi, a little bit in the rural, but not very much. We have our own preconceived ideas of what a rural Kenyan would look like, what their life would be like. How do we get it wrong?
Why? Let me maybe begin by saying this. I remember being a teenager, and by then we had a little, you know, black and white television. I mean, this is like early 90s. It tells you just where, you know, we were as a family or as a country in terms of their economy. Not to say that everybody was like us. You know, there were people in the city that had access to some kind of things we didn't have access to. But coming back to my point, so I remember watching cartoons. Of course, they were American. cartoons. And the scene for Africa, what I saw that when I was a teenager, and it really was eye-opening for me, because they would get on a plane, they would go to Africa, and then they would label the continent, and then they would land, and immediately they were in the jungle. Every single time. It was like there was no gap between the plane landing and then being in the jungle. And I take that is most what the typical average person kind of has in their mind, you know, when they think of village and they think of our neighborhood. Mud huts, and there are mud huts. I mean, they think of extreme poverty, and yes, there's extreme poverty, but it is that and everything in between. And so when someone lands in Nairobi, having that notion of my plane will land, I'll be in the jungle, they get surprised, because there's a measure of what you would call normal city life. Mm-hmm. I lived in Nairobi for 8 years, from 2000 to 2008. So the craziness of the traffic, the disingenuity of the people, the wittiness, the roughness, the city life, and you can tell I grew up in a village, so I don't care for city life. Put me in a small town and I'll be fine. And then, of course, once you go outside of the city, you will find places like our place, where there's no developed government housing per se. There's no plumbing done, there's no streets necessarily. So you have just dirt roads, and you have people just building houses the way they want to build houses. And so there's a lot of lack of planning. But then there's a sense of ownership, and a sense of this is our land, this is our people, this is our community, and you make it what you want. Primarily in Kenya, at least from the part I come from, the houses are built with dressed stone. As opposed to in the Americas, you know, mostly I think is wood, you know, lumber. But where we come from, we have a lot of readily available stones from the quarries and places like that. But if you can't afford, then you can use clay and you can make bricks. And I remember growing up where if a young man wanted to build himself a little place for when, you know, they became a teenager, they were between being, you know, a teenager and an adult. So in that stage, they used to build themselves like a one room, kind of like a studio type deal. And so they would call their friends and they would go down like the valley I mentioned earlier, and they would make bricks out of clay. So they would would cut grass, and they would put grass with the clay. They would kind of mush it on, and then they would use these rectangular wooden boxes to make bricks, and then they would sun dry the bricks. Then they would get either a donkey or some wheelbarrows, and they would carry the bricks, and they would build in a day or two. They would build a house. If you go a little bit back, maybe when my dad was growing up, you would find them in mud houses. So they would go to the forest, they would get some type of wood, some type of frames from the forest. And then they would build a frame of a house, and they would fill it with clay. And then they would roof it with what we call thatched houses. But that was a little bit back. Maybe this is 50s, 60s, 70s. But once there was a lot of literacy and education, people started kind of turning into the modern way of building houses. Now, there are still places in Kenya, especially the western side of Kenya, the kind of like the northern, the farther removed from Nairobi you the further out you drive, the higher the probability that if you get in outside of the limits of a certain city or a certain town, you will find, you know, occasionally those type of places where people live communally still. Yeah.
So what we get wrong is that all of Kenya is jungle.
Right. Yeah.
That is, Nairobi is a large city. So in the city, of course, you have everything from the wealthy to the poor, and from the skyscrapers to the poverty.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember south of Nairobi. What is that region called?
See, now I am not good with cardinal directions. South, north. But to your point, you have the very wealthy, the extremely wealthy people. You have very wealthy neighborhoods. You have the middle income kind of estates and places. And then you have the slums. I think that's where you're going with that question of the south. So Nairobi has this place that's called Kibera Slums. It is the largest slum village in Eastern Central Africa.
Wow.
And so this is a sprawling place that has very simply built houses that are made out of just iron sheets and maybe not even that, just kind of like tarp or something. There's no plumbing. There's no formal road networks once you get into the slum. You can get around, but it's just because there's enough space between one little house and another house. And so there's a lot of crime, there's a lot of poverty, but also a lot of good people who have just, you know, moved from their rural area to get to the city, and they're starting their life. Matter of fact, I remember when I was perhaps 20, between 19 and 20 years old, I had decided to be a business person, and a friend of mine had worked for someone who had a little butchery in those slums, and they had done very well for themselves. And I thought to myself, well, this is not capital intensive. I had saved a little money because I was employed locally. And I thought I'll go and start my own butchery and pay my way through college. And so I went to these slums, even though I ran out of capital after 6 months. I mean, it was a place where if you were ambitious and you didn't have any connections with normal city life, you could go to the slums and begin from there. I mean, these are the people that work in hotels. These are the people that work in offices. They do cleaning. They make the city live, but they themselves are forgotten in a way. But even in those slums, there will be varying degrees of resources. You will have slum lords. They own like, you know, 10, 15 of those little houses, and they are collecting rent on these houses. And so it's quite, you know, I would say, if you'd like to step outside of, if Western culture is all you've known, right? You know, going to a place like Nairobi and visiting the slums would quite open you up to a world that you've never seen. There's nothing like it that I've experienced in my own 16 years in this country.
So you grew up in the rural. Somehow you went to college. Where did you go to college?
Okay, so I grew up in a place called Mangu. So this is I will use kilometers, about 50 kilometers. This is northwest of Nairobi. So about maybe give or take 35 to 40 miles. So grew up there. All the way through eighth grade, right? And then I went to a city called Thika for my high school. Actually, the same school that my dad went to high school.
Okay.
And so that was 4 years. This city was not far from my from where I come from. It's about 20 kilometers, so maybe about 10, 12 miles or so. And then I did 4 years of high school there, went back to the village for 4 years, went back to Thika for just on my college education, which was accounting courses. So I was taking what was then called the Kenya Accounting Technicians course, which is a bridging course into the CPA program. So we could do that. Certifications, the way they used to work then, I don't know if it's they work that way now. You didn't need to have a bachelor's degree to do your CPA.
Mm-hmm.
You could do certifications. You get a technical accounting certificate and then use that to get into the CPA program. So that's what I did in Thika for about a year. And then I moved to Nairobi for college, actually. That's what took me to Nairobi in the year 2000. So there was a school there, an accounting school, right at the heart of the city. I did from 2000 to 2002. I did accounting. But then I ended up staying in Nairobi because I found work. I was working as an accounts payable, an accounts assistant, responsible for accounts payables and receivables. That was my first job. I did that for like 8 months or so. And then I got a phone call that transitioned me into banking. So I was in the heart of Nairobi doing banking for almost 4 years before I emigrated to this country.
So I think you said 16 years ago,
mm-hmm.
you came to the US then?
Yeah.
How was that transition? So what did you get wrong about America? I mean, this might end up being a 5-hour conversation.
I know.
But we got the jungle wrong. What did you get wrong?
Yeah, I remember. Oh, goodness. When my wife and I were having the conversation of, hey, there's this opportunity to relocate.
So you were married at that point.
Right, yes. I was barely married and with less than a one-year-old. And so this opportunity presented itself. And we were at the point where, as a young couple, we were like, okay, let's get a mortgage, you know, or try to build a house. It's either we build a house, buy a car, or go to the United States. So what do we want to do? And we decided we're going to come to the United States. My thinking was first world. I thought that, gosh, and when I look back, I was so ignorant, you know. I thought every place in America looked like, you know, downtown Chicago, downtown Houston, downtown, like the images that they project out there, or you know, made you think, take the best of the neighborhoods in the best of the cities, and that's how I thought all America looked like. When I say it that way, it sounds ridiculous.
Sure.
But for some reason, in my mind, that's what it was, to the extent that when my friend picked us up, we landed in Chicago on Halloween, and that was a shock in and of itself.
I would think so.
Oh my goodness. Let me not digress, but we're driving to his house in Fort Wayne. And I remember looking outside. It was a little late. It was almost midnight. I think we got to his house just a little after midnight. And I was looking outside as we were driving. And we landed. This was Halloween. So by November 1st, we're getting into his house November 1st, you know. And I'm looking outside and I see trees that have no leaves. I had no context of fall because I came from an evergreen climate. So I had never seen, you know, fall in terms of where trees actually completely lose all their leaves. Like I said, growing up in an evergreen kind of like climate, I thought And then I looked, and underneath the trees, there was no vegetation whatsoever. And I'm thinking to myself, so I asked my friend, I said, hey, what happened here? Like, was there a war? Like, was there a fire? And so he's laughing. He said, no, it's fall. I said, what do you mean fall? I didn't even know fall was a thing. You know, we used to call it autumn, you know.
Who doesn't?
Well, no, around this time in the United States, you know, we're approaching winter and the trees will lose their leaves, and then the vegetation will die off, and pretty much everything will die, and the cycle of life begins in the spring. And that was so, like, unbelievable to me. So, and then as we started approaching the city off of the highway, now we were driving, we landed in Chicago, took a connecting flight to Indianapolis, and so okay. He picked us up from Indy and drove us down Fort Wayne. So when we got off the highway and I'm looking at houses, they look like poor people's houses, mm-hmm. like normal people houses. And I'm looking outside and I'm like, what is that they built with here? You know, the siding. I had never seen something like that, you know, coming from, it's either brick or some kind of iron sheet, some kind of metal type sheet, or stones, you know. So looking outside, I couldn't tell what that material was. What is that? Is that wood? What is that? What? But then they looked in just average size homes. There was no seeming and obvious sign of wealth or affluence. It kind of looked normal. And I remember being confused about that, because I was expecting every single house, which sounds really ridiculous now, but I thought every place looked like a center, you know, downtown, best part of town, U.S. And
well, I think it's interesting, you know, what we got wrong was the jungle everywhere.
Yeah.
What you got wrong was the beautiful the houses, yeah, and wealth everywhere.
And, yeah.
And, you know, maybe that's
extremes.
Maybe that's the beauty of, yeah, maybe that's the necessity of traveling.
Yeah.
To see reality, that what we perceive about someone, a culture, a country, a region, whatever, is maybe a grain of truth in it, mm-hmm, but probably mostly wrong.
So true. And isn't that how we treat each other? You know, when I'm sitting across from you, I have perceptions about you and people that look like you. You have perceptions about me and people that look like me. And until we sit down and we engage, and we begin to get to know each other, you're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
He's a normal human being, you know? And it's very eye-opening. And you know, it'll be 16 years this November since we emigrated to the United States. And I've always said, maybe we owe it to ourselves to travel once in our lifetime, to travel out of what we've known, to see what we've not known. Our people have a saying, and I don't even know how to interpret this because I can translate it, but something to the effect of, someone that doesn't travel outside of his home thinks that his mother is the best cook in the world. You know, something like that. Until he goes and tastes other people's food that has spices, and, you know, he realizes, wait a minute, my mother's cooking is good, but there's really good food out there. So, yeah.
I heard somebody say once that before you die, you should plant a tree and write a book. And I think maybe we should add something to that and travel to the other country long enough and stay there long enough to get past the perception that all of Kenya is a jungle.
Yeah.
As the metaphor, right?
Yeah.
And I think you're right.
Yeah. Because
once you get past the facade of what I see in you, mm-hmm, once I get past your facade, I think that's when we start building relationships that last. And I really would value to it that you can put a price to it.
Yeah, think about it this way. If I had the wherewithal when I landed in Chicago to stay in a hotel in downtown Chicago and to drive around Chicago and then get on a plane after maybe 2 weeks and fly back,
my perception of the United States would probably have had remained intact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. But when I went outside of that kind of like protected worldview into the daily life of, you know, rural America and small town America, and I remember I about died when I saw somebody holding up a sign at a roundabout or an intersection saying that they don't have food. I about died. I couldn't believe it that that was possible in America. But what was that? It's that ignorance, that perception that we're talking about. I remember when I was involved in here in Goshen, I attended my first mobile food pantry drive here in Goshen. And we ended up, I think we served, it was 100 and something families. And it blew my mind. I didn't think that food insecurity was a thing. And that this was 2013, or 13 or 14. So of course that got me very involved with the window at that time, which is, you know, right here downtown Goshen. But again, it's the human condition. And so I think that if you do decide to travel, or if you have the opportunity to, and you can get out of the touristy kind of travel, which there's nothing wrong with that, you know. But if you can find a way to get into the reality of things, it will be quite eye-opening. And I think the thing it does, it makes you very thankful. Very thankful. And not necessarily because of what you have, but just thankful overall for what you may not have had and for what you may have had. Yeah.
So you're saying a two-week vacation in Cancun, an all-inclusive resort, does not count as international travel?
I would say that is needed. Needed. We earn those kind of couple weeks, but it will not give you what we're talking about. Yeah.
I think you're right. So you have two kids. Three kids. Okay. Your oldest one must be at least 17.
She will be 17 in October, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because she was a sort of a newborn when you came over.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I see you did the math.
Yeah. No, I'm a bean counter. Then you have two other kids, and what are their ages?
So my son, our middle child, is our son. He will turn 14 in November, and our youngest, Malaika, she will turn 11 next month.
Do they understand Kenyan? How do you keep that bridge intact?
Yeah.
Is it important to you?
Very important to me. Actually, my wife and I made a very conscious decision that we would only try to speak Kenyan as much as possible.
Okay.
There's no Kenyan, but you know what I mean.
Sure.
So it was either Swahili or Kikuyu in the house, and we did that deliberately.
Are they fluent?
Are they fluent? No, unfortunately.
Do they understand?
They do understand, yeah.
I mean, it's pretty tough to be fluent.
Yeah.
Unless you're
good. Yeah. They can barely speak a word. Yeah. Our oldest daughter, has a passion for it. So she will actually listen to some Kenyan music and even sometimes will speak to Margaret and I in Swahili or whatever comes out, right? My son will understand it for the most part. Our youngest, though, seems to have lost a lot of it. She barely can understand as much as the other two. Yeah. So I think the challenge that we have, and like other communities, is our Kenyan community is not as abundant. We're not as many. And so when they get out of the house, they're not able to continue that conversation in Swahili or African language.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Kenyan people in Goshen?
Not in Goshen. South Bend has the majority of Kenyan diaspora. Elkhart also has a sizable community. I think overall in Michiana, if we're to say it that way, there's a good number of Kenyan community residing in Michiana. Yeah.
So what's your greatest accomplishment in life? The thing you're the most proud of? I did this. Yeah, you can be proud for a moment here.
Yeah. I think, and let me answer this going back to your question about Kenya and my kids, and I think that they have this romantic view and they associate Kenya with this place that they go to that is great food and great people. But then again, you know, when we go out there, we try to visit once every 4 years. To them, it's, to us, it's, you know, vacation. We're connecting them to the people, the smells, the sounds, the sights, the soil, so to say. But to them, it's very much a fun time because they didn't experience the challenges of it, the pain of it. But if I was to say my biggest achievement is related to that, I think as much as it has its challenges, I think having a family and trying your best, keep up. I think for me, that's most important. That's the biggest achievement. And I know the story is not over yet, you know, but here we are in 16 years of marriage. And I think that to me is the biggest. And like I said, everyday life will get in the way, career will get in the way, needs and wants will get in the way, but that's I guess my biggest achievement.
Well, you're a Goshen person, but what's your dream for Goshen?
Oh, goodness.
Make all your dreams for Goshen come true.
The first thing, okay, and this may be just at the top of my mind is why so many trains going to Goshen?
Okay, fair enough.
But I think we have a great community. I think we need to solve housing. I think that just like, I think, and this can be said for maybe every place in Indiana specifically as a state, I think housing is a real issue. And not necessarily low income, but affordable housing. I think that there's opportunity there. And maybe diversifying our economy. And I know these are not things like, what are you talking about, Karina? I think that we need to diversify. And that doesn't mean get rid of what we already have, but have grow other industries. If not to the size of where our RV industry is, grow other industries pretty close to that. And I think what that will do, it will cushion our local economy. And he will make this a place where, you know, is even financially for families and for people across the board. Yeah, but I'd like to see, you know, I think of events like First Friday, you know, and how that event brings a lot of people together. So I think we have a very good thing working there, which I think it's been running for, what, like 36 years or something like that?
No. It started in 2007.
Okay.
So 14 or 15 years.
So I think we have something really good going there. How do we leverage things like that? Because I think those type of events help us to see each other from a different lenses and perspectives. They help to bring us together. We begin to see each other as Goshenites, if there's such a thing.
I actually did the math wrong. I got your son's age right, but I got the First Friday wrong.
Right.
17 years.
17 years. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think myself as, you know, kind of solve the world's problems kind of person, but
In my humble opinion, maybe those two things. But
well, you can't solve the world's problem, but you can solve a few of your world's problems.
True.
And that's all we're responsible for is our own world. And when we do that, we make the world better.
So,
any books or movies you watched recently or read that you think we should watch or read?
Well, movies, I think Dune Part 2 came out. I think, I don't know if it's how it's made or if it's the story for me. I haven't read the books. But Empire's Rise and Fall, you know, and the idea that people can rally behind a person and believe in that person and become something or fight for something. I don't know why this morning I was thinking about the civil rights leader, the late Martin Luther King Jr. As I was tying the laces of my shoes, I don't know why I was thinking about him I don't know. Take me back to the question again.
Movies or books?
Yes. So Doom. Yes. Thank you. So, Doom impacted me a lot. And you know, the twist of here you have this identity, you know, House of Atreides or whatever, and then he comes to find out that was not even his father. And the length his mother would go because of what she believed in to even get pregnant from, you know, another person. And that for me, in terms of the humanity of things and agendas and still finding your place in the midst of that chaos, and was quite appealing to me. So anyway, so for that, I would say that. In terms of a book, I'm a very selective reader, I think. And I have a bias to spiritual kind of books. And I can name many, but I think if there's one book that had an impact for me, is a small book, kind of like a read in a day type of book, or maybe 2 days. It's called Angelic Order at Reward by Terry Bennett. Angelic Order at War, and I don't know. When I came across that book and I read it,
and that's a neat great.
I think it has had the greatest impact. Maybe because I'm a naturally curious person, and like I said, I have a spiritual bias. I thought to myself that was the most like. Kind of like eye-opening, and I understand it has a lot to do with someone's experience, right? But isn't that what life is about?
Yeah.
Your convictions shape your philosophy, and your philosophy shapes your life and your beliefs and everything. You know, going back to Martin Luther King, it's because of his convictions that he, you know, did not advocate for violence and believed that everybody needed to treat each other the way they wanted to be treated in a way. So, you know, sort of. And that became what he was known for. And so we cannot discard someone's experience just because it's, that's just based on their experience. You know, we're a very scientific generation. But I think Angelic Order at War by Terry Bennett, by far, small, quick read. A lot of personal experience in it, but also very balanced. From the authority of what he believes is his source, which is the Bible.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I've taken enough of your time. One little tidbit is the coffee that we're serving here, the Kenyan coffee that we serve now, that is actually from Thika.
Oh my goodness.
Which is your home.
That's my hometown. Yeah.
Hometown. Maybe one of your relatives picked it.
Who knows?
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, very possible. Actually, where I grew up, where our family home is, you can take a bike ride and get to the expansive coffee farms. You know, back in the colonial days, they were owned by the British, of course. But yeah, I mean, huge farms, obviously. Coffee farms. So and we used to actually pick coffee there when we were little. For us, it wasn't much of like we needed it. For us, it was most everybody else had to do that to put food on their table. We were lucky enough to not need that way, but the experience of it, we wanted to have the experience of it. And so, you know, I remember going coffee picking and eating some of the berries. They're very sweet.
And they're very sweet, yeah. Well, good. Well, Karu, I'm grateful for you intersecting with my life, and you've made Goshen a better place, and I'm glad you immigrated here. And thanks for taking the time, and it's been a pleasure.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you, Myron.
We had a conversation. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Continue to be reminded that everyone has a story that needs to be told. Take a moment today to listen to someone's story and tell yours as well. Be well, and make your world just a bit better today.